some guys sit down next to him on a commuter train from Yale, where he was teaching, to New York, and they hand him some pages, and they say, "We're working on a play. What do you think?" And the play, you know, turned out to be Hair.
That's drama critic Kenneth Turan talking about Joseph Papp.
And then in the space of 10 minutes on a Friday afternoon at 4:30, I was a person without a job. And so I went home and I made my first dinner in a while and just contemplated like how my life was going to change.
And that's Susan Colon. We talk with her about her memoir, Cherries in Winter. And finally, we also talk with the editor of a new cookbook for college students, The Healthy College Cookbook. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I came into the station one day to find the book, Free for All, in my mailbox. It's about how the great impresario Joseph Papp founded the New York Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater, two institutions that have been a premier source of revolutionary and enduring American theater. As told by drama critic Kenneth Turan, the book brings together the recollections of many great actors, including George C. Scott, Meryl Streep, and James Earl Jones, and Tommy Lee Jones, as well as those of Papp himself. I invited drama critic and author Chris Roman to interview Kenneth Turan about the book.
Thanks, Francesca. I'm talking with Kenneth Turan, who is the film critic for the Los Angeles Times, also film critic on Morning Edition on NPR, and the author, or should I say co-author, of a book called Free for All, Joe Papp, the Public, and the Greatest Theater Story Ever Told. Ken Turan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great talking with you. And I must say, I've read most of Free for All, but not all of it, because I didn't skim it for the high points. I just dug in and read and read and read, and it's a fascinating story.
Well, God bless you for doing that.
It's a wonderful book, and takes me back to some of my experiences in the 60s, in the late 60s and early 70s. I was doing street theater in New York, and we were doing plays about racism in white neighborhoods, and Joe Papp was on our board of advisors. So I met him a couple of times, but I didn't really get to know him. I knew him by reputation, and of course, as you explained very carefully in the book, his reputation was as a visionary who was sometimes hard to get along with. But I want to ask you about, well, first of all, the title of the book, Free for All. It invites a double meaning, and I'm sure you intended that. Tell us about that.
Yes, no, the double meaning couldn't be more intentional. First of all, you know, one of the things that the bedrock of Joe's beliefs and what drove him was the notion initially of free Shakespeare, Shakespeare in the park, Shakespeare in the neighborhoods, Shakespeare that was free for everyone. But also, you know, as you say, Joe, you know, he scrapped with people. You know, there was nothing calm. I mean, he produced a number of extraordinarily significant plays, and not one of them was a tranquil experience. It may be in the nature of theater that plays just do not come into the world easily.
And the book goes into great detail on some of those adventures in theatrical production. I should say, for the benefit of our listeners, that this is not a standard biography by any means. It's actually, you give Joe Papp co-authorship, because it's based on hours and hours of interviews, not only with him, but with some, 160 other people, including Meryl Streep, Kevin Kline, James Earl Jones, Tommy Lee Jones, Martin Sheehan, critics like Clive Barnes, Mike Nichols, the director, George C. Scott, Raoul Julia, Linda Ronstadt, Jerry Stiller, and 150 others. Can you tell us a little about the genesis of the book and why you chose to put it together in this way and how you have put it together?
Sure. You know, this is a book, believe it or not, that was born in my agent's office. Kathy Robbins is my agent, and Joe Papp came to her. He had the idea of wanting to do an oral history about the Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater, and Kathy thought that we would make a good pair. I mean, at that moment, I was a freelance writer. I was not the film critic for the LA Times, and Joe and I had a similar, our ages were different, our backgrounds were similar, and Kathy thought that we would work well together, as really mostly proved to be the case, and Joe wrote letters to all these people encouraging them to cooperate, and they did. They told wonderful, wonderful stories.
And at this time, he was still artistic director, or director everything, of the public theater.
Yes, this was the contract was signed in 1986, and he was still, you know, the most powerful person in New York theater, very much in his prime. And, you know, one of the things that happened is that, as I detail in the book, when I handed my first draft, you know, kind of an overly long kind of first draft into him in the hopes of beginning a kind of a process of getting it down to reasonable shape, he had just found out that he had the prostate cancer that was to kill him. He had just found out that his son, Tony, had AIDS, which was to kill him. And he just was not in the frame of mind to do the work necessary to really work with this manuscript. So he, you know, he could always be mercurial, even in the best of circumstances. And he just said, I don't want this book to come out.
And so it stayed in the can, so to speak, for 20 years almost.
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting situation because sometimes when something bad happens to you, you want the commiseration of your friends. You want people to say, boy, that's really terrible. This was such an awful thing. I didn't even want anyone's sympathy. I just wanted the thing to go away. I wanted to go away. It was really took me more than 10 years before I could even look at the manuscript again once this had happened.
And so what brought it finally to between hardcovers?
Well, a succession or a progression of things. I mean, I really, despite not looking at it for all these years, I always had the feeling that this was really significant, that people had spoken to me and told me these stories about some of the most, you know, significant plays in American theatrical history, and that it was just too important a document not to come out into the world. I just could not let it go. I could not say, well, you know, you win some, you lose some. I've said that with other things, but I couldn't say this with this book. So at a certain point, I wrote a letter to Gail Merrifield Papp, who is Joe's widow and was the director of play development at the Public, very significant person at the Public, and said, basically, what I just said to you, this book is too significant to be dead forever. Is there any way we can bring it back to life? And Gail wrote me back, and she said she thought there was. And this took a number of years for us to finally get to the place where I said, okay, I'm going to look at the book again. I'm going to read it again and see what I think. And then I read it. I thought I saw potential to do another draft. I finally found the time to do another draft, and I did another draft, and everyone was happy.
And I'm happy, too. We're very grateful that it's here. Let's take a step back and remind listeners or inform listeners who may not be aware of exactly what the Public Theater and the New York Shakespeare Festival is and was.
Well, the Shakespeare Festival, you know, came out of nowhere. I mean, it came out of Joe's, you know, it's now an institution, that part of it. You know, the Shakespeare Festival and the Public Theater are kind of two names for the same institution.
The Shakespeare Festival is the free Shakespeare performances in Central Park, which has been going on since the 1960s, I believe.
No, since the 50s, actually.
The 50s.
It's been going on for quite some time. You know, Joe was a very poor kid. He grew up in Brooklyn in extreme poverty. He learned about Shakespeare in high school in Eastern District Public School in Brooklyn, and it became a passion of his. And when he was in the Navy in World War II, and when he got out, he just decided theater was what he wanted to do. And gradually he got the idea that Shakespeare had meant so much to him, he felt it could mean that much to everyone, and really in any neighborhood, in any part of the city. And he got the idea first for a mobile theater. He literally had a flatbed truck, and they had a stage on the back, and he kind of encouraged, there were always capable actors in New York who are looking for work, even if the pay is minimal or non-existent. And he got this troupe together. They toured around the boroughs in the varying parks. Neighborhood people came out to watch Shakespeare, really enjoyed it. And they did some performances in Central Park, and then he decided maybe they would just stay in Central Park for a while.
And that's some of the most compelling passages in the book are those early days, you know, the struggles in the basement of the church and all of that, but also the mobile theater where people came out who had never seen theater before and sat there at first skeptical, but then totally entranced, but then they also got rocks and bottles thrown on the stage.
Yes, I mean, you know, I mean, it's never a fairy tale when you go out into the neighborhoods of New York, but ultimately people liked the plays. I mean, Joe's vision, Joe's notion that anyone could appreciate Shakespeare if they just sat down and looked and listened turned out to be true. You know, and you know, one of the things that kind of cemented Joe's reputation was his battle with Robert Moses, who at that point was really the most powerful man in New York City, maybe the most powerful man in New York State.
Who was the commissioner of parks.
He was the commissioner of parks.
And among, lots of other things.
Yeah, among many, many other things. And he decided that there was just something wrong with Shakespeare being free, and, you know, that was wear and tear on the park, and he wanted the Shakespeare Company to contribute to it. And so he kind of mandated that Joe charge admission. And Joe absolutely refused. And not only did he refuse, he took Robert Moses to court, and he said, you can't make me charge admission. And, you know, no one had ever challenged Robert Moses. This was just not done.
It was interesting that Moses seemed to be almost offended at the idea that people could see quality theater for nothing.
Yeah, it just bothered him for some reason. I mean, he'd probably be the only person who could explain exactly why, but it did kind of bother him. And But Joe won the court case and got an enormous amount of publicity in the process. And it turned out to be a great thing for him. But again, as in many things in Joe's career, this was not a plan. This was Joe following what he believed in down the line. He believed in things and acted on his beliefs.
He was very instinctual, I get the impression from the book.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like he didn't have any choice. His instincts and his drives were so powerful that he just had to go with them. And it was the same with picking plays. You know, at some point he decided he wanted to do contemporary plays as well. He acquired an old building in downtown Manhattan that became the Public Theater. And then the question became, what was he going to open the theater with? And he'd never done a new play. He'd only done Shakespeare. He didn't really know how to go about finding a new play.
And the new play was?
Well, but the new play turned out, first he thought he was going to do a British play, something called Sergeant Musgrave's Dance. You know, and then he said, well, you know, I just don't know that I really want to do that. It's a British play. And then some guys sit down next to him on a commuter train from Yale, where he was teaching, to New York, and they hand him some pages, and they say, we're working on a play. What do you think? And the play, you know, turned out to be Hair. You know, but that's the way Hair came into the world, because Joe followed his instincts. He read these kind of pages, which were not totally finished. There was no music. And he saw something there, and he said, I'm going to go forward with this. And everyone thought he was crazy.
And there are some wonderful quotes from the section on Hair. For instance, Shelley Plimpton, who was discovered, I guess, in a restaurant.
Yeah.
Joe, and was it Bernard Gerstein, who was the managing director of the Public, saw her in a restaurant, I guess were attracted to her waif-like qualities or something, and said, so can you act? No. Can you sing? No. Can you dance? No. Well, come down and audition anyway. And she ended up in the original production of Hair and on the Broadway, in the Broadway production as well.
Right, and she has this wonderful quote where she said she's been very suspicious of stuff. There was a lot of basement theater going on, and she didn't want to be involved in basement theater. Mm-hmm. You know, she wanted something more significant than, you know, the New York Shakespeare Festival Public Theater. Didn't sound like basement theater, so she agreed to audition.
And she says, it was fun. I remember having fun every day. That's all I remember. But just above that quote is Theoni Aldridge, the costume designer, saying, I don't remember it as being a very happy experience. So that kind of encapsulates so many places in the book, especially the actors, say, gee, it's just fun working for Joe Papp, working in one of his productions, having the freedom. Kevin Kline talks about how it's just the show, it's not the business.
Yes, no, Joe, I mean, Joe loved actors, and Joe really, I mean, you know, it's almost uncanny. He had an eye for people who became enormous stars. I mean, the list of major actors that Joe gave their first significant parts to, you know, Meryl Streep, George C. Scott, Martin Sheen, you know, you say, well, of course you're going to see that these people are going to be great. But in fact, other people had not seen they were going to be great. Other people had not hired them. And Joe had this gift for discerning talent in playwrights and in actors, which was quite remarkable.
Even when somebody came in and did a terrible audition, he saw it and he stuck with somebody.
Yeah, no, I mean, George C. Scott tells these great stories about how he banged around as an actor for a couple of years in the Middle West, never got anywhere, and he finally got to New York, and Joe gave him an audition. This was when Joe was really, really beginning. This was in the 50s. He was in a theater in Upper Manhattan, and George C. Scott gave a terrible audition, and he knew it, and everyone knew it, and he didn't get the part. And he said, I'd never done this before. I called Joe up, and I said, I want to come back and do it again. I want to come back and do it again. Mm-hmm. And Joe let him do it, and, you know, as I say, the rest is history.
One of the things you say in the introduction is you refer to the towering disputes that Pap had with everyone. But my experience of the book is that a lot of those towering disputes aren't as much in evidence as people, you know, as I just said, having fun, really, you know, appreciating the work that they were able to do with him. Is that because the people that you were able to talk to or that Joe wanted you to talk to were the ones that he didn't have such towering disputes with, or what?
Yeah, well, I think it was, you know, there's a wonderful quote, I think it is in the introduction as well, where there's a playwright that Joe had a huge fight with, who, you know, they're a few weeks after the fight, they're at a party, and Joe comes up to the playwright and starts chatting amiably with him. And the guy says, "Joe, why are you talking to me? We had this astonishing fight." And Joe said, "You know, if I didn't talk to the people I had fights with, I'd have no one to talk to."
That's right.
You know, and I think what happened mainly with Joe was that everything was great until it wasn't great. You know, and depending on which part of the experience you talk to people about, that's what you get. I mean, people really felt when Joe was on your side, when you were in sync with him, there was just no better theatrical experience to be had. But often it would happen that at a certain point things would diverge, or Joe would go down another path. Joe was always, you know, had this kind of shark-like quality of always moving forward, and sometimes he would leave people behind, and people didn't want to be left behind.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the early days that the first part of the book is about, when, well, as you said, when, you know, he grew up in extreme poverty, but was always a scrapper, always trying to make something happen, and put on little shows in the Navy and all of that. And then ended up at first in the Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. I guess it was the basement or the abandoned chapel, which was his first theater.
Yeah, no, I mean, this was a church way east of Manhattan, Avenue C and Avenue D, you know, parts of Manhattan that were godforsaken even 20 years later. And in the 50s, like, no one was down there. But Joe found this, you know, he walked around the neighborhood. He loved to walk around New York. He found this church. He went inside. He met the pastor, who was a kindly guy, who said, "Absolutely, you want to do Shakespeare here? I love the idea." You know, they had to find seats. I mean, they had to get the place heated. I mean, nothing was simple. It was a struggle. I mean, Joe was a real Joe believed. You know, I think really the secret of his success and the reason people were attracted to him was that this was not an act. You know, this was not a reason to get power or a reason to get celebrity. This notion of free theater for everyone was like Joe's religion. He believed in it that deeply, that strongly.
And making theater available to people who wouldn't go to Broadway, wouldn't think of putting down that kind of money for a ticket, had never considered going to the theater before, but bringing theater to the masses, as he put it.
Absolutely. You know, there's a line you hear in Hollywood a lot where, you know, it's my day job as being a film critic, where people, you know, there's often not very good films coming out of the studios, and often the line you hear from development executives is that it's too smart for the room. You know, this is a project that will be over people's heads.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe did not believe this. Joe did not believe that theater or Shakespeare was too smart for the room. He felt the room would get it just fine, and he proved to be correct.
Yeah, and the productions were very lively, but not talking down to an audience.
No, absolutely not. I mean, Joe absolutely believed that people would get Shakespeare. I mean, it was just an absolute credo for him.
And he also pioneered the idea that Shakespeare didn't have to be John Gielgud, that it could be in not only an American accent, but, for instance, a Puerto Rican accent.
Yeah. I mean, he felt that, you know, it was an infinitely, you know, I think he felt that was part of Shakespeare's greatness, that there were so many ways you could approach it, so many things you could do to it, so many different ways you could put it on, that it was a great thing to try all these different versions.
You're listening to Writer's Voice. Guest co-host Chris Roman is talking with LA Times critic Kenneth Turan about his new book, Free for All. It's about the life and work of the great theater producer Joseph Papp, founder of the Public Theater and Shakespeare in the Park.
It seemed to me also, especially in the early days, that Joseph Papp was the recipient of a lot of lucky breaks. Things just fell in his path, and he had the smarts or the instinct or whatever to pick them up. But for instance, well, you know, one little one is finding the wedding ring in the gutter. With his, what, first wife,
yeah,
second wife?
Yeah, well, probably was his third wife.
Okay, yes. He ended up with four.
Four, yes.
But can you tell the story about how he got into the Actors Lab in Los Angeles?
he'd been in the Navy. He'd put on plays on the Navy. You know, he'd just kind of fallen into this, more or less, partly because of his love of Shakespeare out of high school. And, you know, interesting enough, one of the people, when he told me this, I couldn't believe it, but one of the people, one of the young, barely 19, 20-year-old sailors who'd been in his troop was Bob Fosse, who later went on to be a real giant of American theater himself.
Right.
And Joe got out. He was mustered out. And he heard about this place. That was the GI Bill. You could go to college. He heard about this place called the Actors Lab, which was out in Los Angeles. And he went down there, and he just kind of stumbled into things. Things happened for him. He was able to just kind of get a job, get an audition, get into the thing. It just really happened. As you say, he just in some ways had, a gift for being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, the part of the story I remember is he showed up and they said, no, you're too late for the audition. And he just sort of sat down on a bench beside the box office or wherever it was. And they said, oh, you, can you come in and read with somebody who's auditioning?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But, one of the things about Joe that I think is worth pointing out is that there was a sense, when he was at his height, and a lot of people resented his power and resented his influence. People would say, yes, Joe has accomplished a lot. He's done a lot. But really, if it hadn't happened to him, it would have happened to someone else. We would have had these kind of plays from another producer. And, in the year since his death, he died in 1991. In the year since, it's almost, 20 years at this point, there really hasn't been anyone like him. There hasn't been anyone who made theater as vital, as exciting, so part of the social fabric. I mean, so I think sometimes the gifts of a producer are underrated. You think, well, anyone can raise the money and put things together and hold the troupe together. This is not really the creative part of theater. But really, the way Joe did it, it was a key creative part of theater.
Absolutely. And another key creative part of his aesthetic was, as he said, bringing theater to the masses, which got him in trouble with the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was invited to testify and name names. And then didn't.
He wouldn't do it. I mean, Joe was a man of principle above everything else, and he just would not do it. He told me when he testified it was a banner headline in the New York Journal American, and I thought he was exaggerating, and I went through the Journal American archives, and lo and behold, there's an 8-column banner headline about his testimony. It was a big deal. Joe refused to testify. He lost his job at CBS. He'd been a floor manager, kind of a stage manager for live TV. He lost his job. But it was not a question for him of naming names. He couldn't do it. He couldn't go against his principles.
I remember reading something he said in the course of your book, that if he went to jail for contempt of Congress, that would be the end of the Shakespeare Festival, but he still couldn't do it.
Yeah. This was not something he did lightly, but it just was not it really finally could not do it.
There are loads of places in the book and whole chapters devoted to the great successes of the Public Theater and the Shakespeare Festival. Not only Hair, but A Chorus Line, For Colored Girls who have remind me of the title. Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. The Normal Heart, which I think was the first play to really take on the AIDS issue straight ahead. But then, of course, there were some disasters, like The Naked Hamlet, which was totally the deconstructed Hamlet, which took the five major soliloquies and then put other pieces of the play around it, and True West, starring Tommy Lee Jones and Peter Boyle, who both of them, I think, agree were totally miscast, and the director was either quit or fired before the show opened. So there were some flops along the line.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, but Joe was always in the battle. He was never deterred by the flops. He just felt that either something had been, he had made a mistake or other mistakes had been made or just things hadn't gone right. But he was, he had a cause. He had something he believed in, and he just went on to the next play. I think finally he produced something like 350 plays, and that's quite a record.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Oh, and I almost forgot to mention The Pirates of Penzance, which is one of my favorite public theater shows ever, where they took Gilbert and Sullivan. Everybody hated it, but Joe was what? He was whistling a tune from the Mikado and asked the director to do the Mikado, and the director went and got the record of Pirates of Penzance out because the cover looked better, and it turned into this wonderful, exuberant musical, not really a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta, starring Kevin Kline and Linda Ronstadt.
Yeah, it was quite something. And again, you know, some of it, as you say, was kind of happenstance. Will Leach, the director, I mean, just liked, you know, he went to the record store and the Pirates of Penzance was there and he took it. And he said, well, let me listen to this one. You know, so a lot of it seems like happenstance, but when happenstance happens so often, there's something else going on.
So often it comes down to Joseph Papp's good nose, as somebody says in the course of the book.
Absolutely. You know, he just had a gift for these things. I mean, you know, as you know, we talked about hair. I mean, almost anyone else would have just told these guys, leave me alone. You know, even in fact, Joe says, I just wanted to read my paper. I didn't want to talk to these guys. And but he did. And, you know, the same thing happened with A Chorus Line. You know, when, you know, Michael Bennett had this vague idea for a play and Joe said, okay, work on it in my theater. I'll give you the resources to work on it. Some of the plays he did that won Pulitzer Prizes, that championship season, No Place to Be Somebody. Nobody wanted these plays. It's not like Joe outbid other interested parties and that's how he got them. Everyone had rejected these plays, but Joe saw something in them. Joe saw something in the playwrights, and that's a remarkable thing.
So the public theater is kind of an orphanage where where unwanted children come and thrive.
I mean, it's really true. I mean, like I say, when these things become successes, you tend to think, well, of course, anyone could have picked out Hair or anyone could have picked out A Chorus Line. The reality is no, and everyone could not.
Absolutely not. The book is Free for All, with a double meaning, free for everybody, theater for the masses, and the implication of pillow fight. Joe Papp, The Public and the Greatest Theater Story Ever Told, compiled, written by, well, how would you put yourself, Ken Turan?
I don't know. It's a good question.
put together into a fascinating oral history by Kenneth Turan. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was guest co-host Chris Roman speaking with Kenneth Turan. Chris Roman is the author of A World of Ideas, the former editor for the Oxford Guide to Classical Mythology and the Arts, and is drama critic for public radio station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Next up, we talk with Suzanne Cologne about her memoir, Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Last year, Suzanne Cologne found herself in the same position many Americans are finding themselves today, unemployed. When she got laid off from her job at a magazine, at first she felt a great loss of identity and wasn't sure how she was going to cope, both psychologically and financially. But then she found a silver lining in the form of recipes handed down to her from her grandmother and her mother. Good, cheap, stick-to-the-ribs recipes that had held her family together in hard times as well as good. Cologne found solace and wisdom in them and the memories they brought, and the material for her memoir, Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. I started out by asking Suzanne Cologne how things changed for her when she lost her job.
Well, I went from being this person who was, you know, rushing off to this job that I really loved, you know, taking two trains to get there and then getting into this very glamorous building where people would say, oh, you work there? And I'd be like, yes, I do. And then I would work a very long day and get home about 8:45 or something, and my husband Nathan on those late nights would tend to make dinner first, which was just so great of him. And usually it was something that we had bought prepared, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, and then I would start the cycle all over again for the work week, and sometimes I'd be working on the weekends. And then in the space of 10 minutes on a Friday afternoon at 4:30, I was a person without a job. And so I went home and I made my first dinner in a while and just contemplated, like, how my life was going to change. And I took very, very little time off. I think it was maybe a couple days to sort of wrap my mind around what had happened. And then I just started thinking to myself, you know what? I've got to do something, and the only thing I know how to do is write. I became this person who works at home and freelances desperately, and I became open to all sorts of odd jobs.
This wasn't an entirely unfamiliar situation for you. In some ways, you were better prepared, perhaps, than many people, because you grew up in circumstances, and we're not even talking about your grandparents' generation yet, but you grew up in circumstances in which there had to be some belt tightening. Your mother and father divorced when you were two, and there's a marvelous little vignette you have in the book, Cherries in Winter, when your mother came home and you complained that the TV was broken.
Yes. I really have to credit this moment with me becoming a lover of books and eventually a writer when the TV broke. And, you know, I was a latchkey kid. When I didn't have babysitters, I just got home a couple of hours before my mother did. And so with that couple of hours, I usually watched TV. One day the TV broke and Mom came home and I said, you know, excuse me, the TV is broken. We have to get it fixed. And she said, there's no money to get it fixed. And I don't know. I believe that was true, but I also believe that it just wasn't a priority for her because, you know, she loves books. She's always been a big reader. And I said, I was just absolutely shocked. I said, what am I supposed to do until you get home? And she said, get a library card and read a book. In that tone of voice where you know that the discussion is pretty much over if you value your young life. So I did that. I did get a library card. I did read books, many of them, and my reading level shot up incredibly that year. But yeah, I grew up, you know, when you say that the belt was tight, everything was tight. The pants were tight, the belt was tight. You know, I just grew up not even knowing that there were any notches on that belt. It was, you know, cinched very tightly.
And when you got laid off this last time, your mother told you to put up soup.
Yes.
What did she mean?
Well, that's an old expression in our family, and it has two meanings. One of them is quite literal, that you are just going to get out your heavy cast iron pot or your slow cooker or whatever it is that we have had for many years. And you just make a big batch of soup that is really inexpensive to make and is going to be very hearty and filling and last for, you know, a week if need be. And the other meaning is that, you know, that's sort of the signal for, okay, we're heading into a tight time right now. Things are going to be a little rough. You know, I had become used to making something of a comfortable living, relatively speaking. I mean, I'm certainly no millionaire, but my husband and I did not have anything, we didn't have any major financial concerns. But when I lost my job, suddenly things got thrown into very sharp relief. You know, I just lost a six-figure salary. Okay, time to put up soup.
And your 401k wasn't doing so hot either.
Oh, that poor thing took a beating. Oh, my goodness. I tell you, I played by the rules like everybody was told to do. I made the maximum contribution, and then I watched it disappear into I don't know where. I have no idea what happened to it. I know that the mail came whimpering to me one day with the new figures, and I just thought to myself, okay, well, let's start again from the beginning.
Yeah. Tell us really how your life changed in terms of the, you know, the little things that add up. What did you have to cut back on?
Oh, we cut back on everything except for health insurance. The health insurance went to COBRA for us, and we elected to throw as much into that as we possibly could because we were in a very fortunate position of, you know, we didn't have a high mortgage or anything like that. We didn't have any crazy expenses, so we could really afford to keep the level of health insurance that we had, which, you know, to some people was almost a decadent level. But, you know, my husband occasionally suffers small injuries as a result of his work as a repairman, and I am not willing to take the chance that, you know, we would be cut short, you know, in that area. But in other areas, you know, I definitely cut back on things like food. You know, I used to buy organic this and free-range that and deluxe this and prepared that, And then all of a sudden it was the bag of beans. What do I do with this? You know, we ate a lot of pasta and it was homemade. No more jarred sauce. And I tried to keep the level good. But at the same time, we did sell our truck. Vacations were out of the question. We cut the cable back. And everything that Americans have been doing now for the past year. You know, no more new clothes. You know, yeah, it was just, and it was fine. It was fine. Mm-hmm. All of it, we, you know, as long as we had each other, everybody was healthy in the family, we were good.
We're talking with Suzanne Colon about her book, Cherries in Winter, My Family's Recipe for Hope in Hard Times. Now, this book, which is a marvelous read, it has recipes, yes, in it, but it has a lot of family history, a lot of memoir of your own, and it centers very much around the person of your grandmother, Nana. Her name was Matilda.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
She was my idol. When I was little, I only had her for the first 7 years of my life before she passed away. But I remember her so clearly as just being this tall, stylish, very chic. She was a lot of fun. You know, it's like this woman who could be extremely, like, just chic and well-dressed and so well put together and so proper would get down on the floor with me and create a little house out of sheets between two chairs, and she'd make us lunch on doll plates, and she'd be right in there with me in our little makeshift house, playing house with me. And I just thought she was amazing. She was just very, very attractive. She was what people would call back in the time a handsome woman. And she wasn't beautiful like my mother, who was a model. She was, you know, just a complete showstopper, that one. But Nana had a lot of style, and she had this beautiful white hair that she styled very similar to Marilyn Monroe with a little swoop over her eye. And I just thought to myself, you know how when you're little and you like to play dress-up? And I thought to myself, I cannot wait till I'm bigger and I can look like Nana. And as I got older, I wanted to be like her. I'm still working on that part. I'm working on both, actually.
She also forms kind of the center of this book because so many of her recipes make it into the book. She lived in the Bronx, then she and her husband bought a farm. Talk a little bit about how she did recipes, about her cooking.
Well, it's interesting because my Nana and I, without me intentionally sort of following her life path, she and I had very similar adulthoods in that we were both career girls from an early age, working in offices and things like that. So we didn't really learn how to cook until a bit later in life. My Nana was working in an office from the time she was 16 years old during the Depression, and she was the only member of her family able to hold down a job. So she wasn't really at home learning how to be a wife from her mother. Her mother, Carrie, did all of the cooking in the house, but she didn't really pick that up, my Nana. So when my grandpa bought the farm in Saratoga, all of a sudden my Nana left her job and was thrust into this world of a crumbling old farmhouse that had a hearth for a stove. And she was sort of desperate to figure out, okay, what do I do with this thing? How do I feed my family? And, you know, there's these chickens running around, and they're trying to plant vegetables and everything. At any rate, she and my grandpa joined an association called The Grange, which is still in existence. It's an association for farmers to gather and share information. And my Nana had to appeal to the ladies of The Grange who shared recipes. That was one of their activities. And they asked her one day, Matilda, what do you have to contribute? And she said, you know, I'll make a deal with you. If you teach me how to cook and bake and can, I will come to your houses and do your hair and your makeup and your nails, because my Nana was still very much a city woman. She was still doing her hair. She was putting on makeup. She was painting her nails. She hadn't really left the office, even though she had left the office. And the ladies just thought this was the best bargain they could possibly strike. So my Nana learned how to cook, and the ladies of The Grange got little beauty lessons, and there was part of it The other part was there were a few recipes that Nana picked up from her mother and from her grandmother. My great Aunt Nettie's clam chowder and the German potato salad recipe that's in the book comes from my great-great-grandmother who was born in Alsace-Lorraine.
Wow.
Yeah.
And talking about chicken and chicken recipes, it's interesting that your grandmother had a very different way of writing recipes. You have two versions of chicken pie a la Mississippi. Read that recipe for us.
Yes, chicken pie a la Mississippi. In the old-fashioned method, start with a 4-pound chicken. Cut the chicken up as you would for frying and simmer the pieces in boiling water until tender. About 30 minutes before the chicken is done, add a chopped onion or two. Add a dash of pepper, a dash of salt, and a little Worcestershire sauce. Leave the bones in the chicken. When it's tender and in a pan, add dumplings. Then make a sauce, melted butter and flour, and about 2 cups of chicken broth. Pour it over the chicken and dumplings. For the top, make a good baking powder biscuit dough, rolled thin, cut in finger-length strips 1 inch wide. When the pie is covered, put it in the oven to brown.
What strikes me about this is the assumption that people know how to make dumplings and biscuits.
I know. Isn't that something? This was from a different era. I mean, this was from the era where you just have biscuit dough on hand or would say to yourself, oh, yeah, I'll just whip that up. I mean, I do remember the women in my family not actually having any written recipes. Certainly my grandpa didn't. They would just know instinctively, it seemed to me, how much flour to put in a bowl, how many eggs went in there. I mean, it was just something that you learned by watching. And, you know, yeah, there is this assumption that you're just going to know, oh, yeah, biscuit dough. Whereas that threw me completely. I thought, biscuit dough. I mean, the rest of the modern recipe continues with, instead of strips of dough, cover the pie with small baking powder biscuits. Oh, okay.
Right. And actually, you don't say how to make those either, although this is a more precise recipe.
Yes, this is the definitely more precise recipe. What I did, you know, I wanted to preserve the integrity of the original recipes, which, you know, the original documents are shown in the book. So you can see my Nana's handwriting, the typing, you know, the little notes that she had on things. I would just take whatever recipe she had, because I believe this in the spirit of recipes. It's a little bit more difficult with baking, but I love being able to take a recipe and sort of improve upon it or at least put my mark on it or make it a little bit different. And so I would take her basic instructions and then, you know, if I had to go and look up, okay, biscuits, I'm just going to make biscuit dough. I've never done this before, but I'm going to give it a try. And it turned out fine. Actually, this is one of my husband's favorite recipes now.
Oh, that's great. You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Suzanne Colon about her memoir, Cherries in Winter. It's about getting laid off and rediscovering family food traditions and recipes that help to ease the bite of hard times. Your grandmother's recipes were in a kind of accordion folder, is that
yes.
right?
Yes.
And you say they, as you went through them, you discovered that they were a kind of timeline of America's eating patterns.
It really was interesting to put them together in some sort of order if I was able to do so. I mean, things weren't dated, but I could tell if something had been around longer just by the condition of the paper. You know, I mean, is it completely yellow? Is it yellow on the edges? She also saved a lot of those little pamphlets that people could send away for in those days. I think you still can now, but it used to be, you know, send in 2 box tops and we'll send you a recipe pamphlet. And so she had a lot of those. Those were dated. And so you could see things, little booklets, 1939, 1942, 1948, 1953, you know, so you could see what the country was going through. It was really amazing. It was such an interesting study of when is butter available? When does it switch to margarine? Things like that. You know, when is flour available and when is it being sent out to the troops? And so they're using substitutes, soy flour. When are people using lard? You know, when was lard an acceptable fat to use? Well, when it was pure. when it was not treated with any sort of chemicals or hormones or antibiotics, things like that, lard, beef fat, all of those were perfectly acceptable to use. But you really can see when you look at these things, you know, when are people going to Europe after the war? It was really remarkable.
You mean because they brought recipes back from Europe?
Magazines. My Nana ripped things out from magazines, and so you would see that some of the recipes were classic American cooking, you know, chicken pot pie, meatloaf, mashed potatoes, that type of thing. And then somewhere in the early 1950s, all of a sudden there are these articles about how you can recreate at home the food that you ate while touring Europe. Touring Europe.
and not in the Army, we'll say.
Not in the Army, no, but that's interesting because that you bring that up, because that is where a lot of people, a lot of the men who were stationed overseas, the men and women who were stationed overseas, brought home a taste for things Italian, things French, all of the things that they had been eating while they were abroad. And so all of a sudden you see things like recipes for lasagna, which, you know, previously had been made only by Italian immigrants. So that was fascinating to me. But yes, the 1950s was a really great time for hors d'oeuvres, apparently.
People were entertaining.
Yes, they were. Yeah. They were entertaining.
It's interesting. Your mother said, I believe this was your mother, said that we may have been broke, maybe that was when you were growing up or in the Great Depression. We may have been broke, but we were never poor.
Yes, yes. That was actually Nana's saying, and Mom also said it. We had many occasions to say such things.
What do you think they meant by that?
Well, I think it's just a state of mind. For one thing, they were either aware in my family or hopeful that really desperate times would pass. For example, I know that when my grandmother was growing up, there were many times where the family would just have mashed potatoes and coffee for dinner because that's all they could afford. That's what they had on hand, and that was going to be it. But they knew that that time would pass, and to them, they would prefer to think of themselves as being temporarily broke rather than poor. Poverty to them was also a state of mind that could really grip one and keep one in a bad way, would lead to giving up, in other words. So it was very, very vitally important that they remain optimistic and say, well, you know, we may have been broke, but we were never poor. Irish accent added. You know, I mean, it was very, very important to them that they not remain in the grips of the idea of poverty.
And this has something to do with your title, doesn't it? Cherries yes. in Winter.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell us
absolutely.
The story.
Well, you know, as I said, hard times in my family have sometimes had to do with the state of the economy on a large scale and other times just been the way we were. You know, I mean, not any great gamblers in my family or anything like that, but people lose jobs, people go through hard times. And so, again, there was that state of mind of, okay, we're broke, but we're not poor. Occasionally, my Nana would spend a little bit of money on an indulgence that would make her feel a little bit better. And when she was working at the Coliseum, which was a convention center located in Columbus Circle in New York, where the Time Warner Center is actually now, there was around the corner a fruit purveyor who would get in fancy fruits, you know, just things that were really of high quality, like gorgeous jumbo prunes, which people might not get too excited about, but, you know, maybe if you said dried plums now. But he would also occasionally, very rarely, have fruit out of season. Now, this is something that today we have mangoes year-round. We don't really know what the words out of season mean. But back in that time, which was the late 1950s, the idea of having something like cherries in winter was just such a luxury. And so my Nana would spend a little more to make herself feel better about having less.
Yeah, and I think it's really a lovely story there. You write that when she died, when you were seven, that you were hungry all the time after she died. Why was that?
I just, you know, I really have trouble remembering that time because it was just such a blank for me and for my mother. We were very, very close family, always have been. And I didn't feel a hole in me. I felt like a hole. You know, I just didn't feel that there was a part of me that hadn't been scattered to the four corners of my room. And to see my mother suffering so without her mother, it was a really, and it was just the two of us, of course, in the apartment. It just was a really, it was the first time I really experienced, I guess, what would now be called depression. But back then, I was just, say, I was just terribly, terribly sad. I remember a lot of Entenmann's chocolate cake. I really do. I really remember Entenmann's chocolate cake, just eating it by the forkful, saving a little square for my mother. Yeah, that was one afternoon blended into another. And it was like that for a while for us. It really was.
Mm. What do you think your grandma would think of you writing this book?
Oh, I have really had a wonderful time imagining that. I know that one of the most amazing discoveries I made while writing this book was that my Nana wanted to be a writer. I had never known that before finding her personal papers and that she wrote about her life in magazine articles and would-be book chapters that were never published. And the idea that now some of her work has been published, I think, would just thrill her to pieces. But also, I think she'd just be happy that about my intention with the book, which was, I really was not feeling great last year when I got laid off. And I think the whole country was in, if not a technical economic depression, certainly an emotional depression. And I really wanted to make people feel better and to remind them of their own family stories, to look back and remember, oh, we went through a hard time. We got through that okay. We'll get through this okay, too, and perhaps even better in some ways. And I, you know, I like to say that I wrote the book I needed to read, and I think that my Nana would be very happy about that intention because she certainly tried in her own way to put that forth as well.
Susan Colon, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Wondering what to give your son or daughter when they come home for the holidays after a semester away at college? How about the Healthy College Cookbook? Revised and updated from the first edition, published 10 years ago, it brings together a published 10 years ago by Story Press, it brings together a slew of cheap, easy, and yummy recipes that are written and tested by college students. I invited editor Rachel Holcomb into our studio. She's a student here at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and former chef in the bake shop of one of the on-campus dining commons. Rachel Holcomb, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
So this is the Healthy College Cookbook. What is meant by healthy?
My view looking at the old one and looking at all the new recipes that we got was trying to find things that had simple ingredients and that were overall healthy. So things with vegetables, things with less butter, less salt, trying to really use everything I knew about cooking and what other people know and what's been out now in the media about good and bad and applying it to the recipes I was looking at. Because in college, you know, there's always the fear of the freshman 15 and no one wants to gain the freshman 15.
What's the freshman 15?
Your first year of college when you gain extra weight because you're suddenly not at home anymore and there's all these different food choices out there for you and you have to make the right healthy choices. And this way, cooking for yourself with the simple recipes, you know what you're cooking, you know what you're eating. There's a nutrition guide in there so you know how many calories, how many carbs, how many sugar, you know, how much sugar is in everything. So you're very aware of what you're eating and that makes it easier to be healthy.
You start with the basics, the real basic things. Tell us how you start out this book and why did you feel you needed to kind of, you know, even put in a definition of a pot?
We were thinking about kids who maybe have never cooked before, kids whose parents were, you know, they did family dinner every day, so they didn't have to worry about cooking, and suddenly they're at college, and they don't have mom or dad around to help them anymore, or their big brothers or sisters, so they're on their own, and they, you know, recipes use, it's a language, a cooking language, so this guide in the beginning helps to define everything and answer any questions that they might have about simple words and simple language.
The subtitle is Quick, Cheap, and Easy. Those are magical words, I think not just to college students, but probably to a whole lot of people who are quite busy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the things I definitely looked at was how much time it seems to take things to make and how many ingredients were listed, because especially for me, groceries are very expensive. And even if you check the circular every week and you look for your coupons, you still end up spending a lot of money. And this way, there's few ingredients, but you still get a good food from it. And I think that's key, instead of having to buy 15 different ingredients and use, you know, a tablespoon of each to make something.
I thought a great example in here was the ramen noodle stir fry. I mean, ramen noodle is kind of your cliche for college
food. This just amps it up a bit, makes it more interesting.
So what's healthy and what's cheap? Well, cheap ramen noodles are pretty cheap, but what's healthy and quick about this stir fry?
Let's see, it uses the ramen noodles, you have peppers, onions, garlic, and a little bit of hot sauce, so it just adds some flavor, you get some vegetable in there. It only has a teaspoon of olive oil, which isn't bad for you. And besides the dry noodles, there's really not too much complicated in it, there's not too much processed food. You're seeing everything that you put into it, you're chopping up the vegetables, so it's a quick cleanup. It's only onions and peppers and some garlic with oregano.
So a lot of this is from scratch.
Yes. Yes, it's scratch cooking, a lot of it.
And what's the advantage of that?
I always thought of scratch cooking as more wholesome and more good, but that's because I grew up with it. If I do go to the store and buy a meal that I can make for myself, like a packaged box type meal, it has a lot of high sodium and a lot of high carbs, but that's something I know going into it. But this, because they don't take much longer than a recipe like that, it is really healthy for you. You just have to be motivated enough to go do it, and we all get lazy, but this book is so simple and so easy, and it's still really good, which is the key.
That's great. And you go from simple recipes like ramen noodle stir fry to something a little more fancy like African groundnut stew. Which, you know, I was surprised to find in a cookbook that is simple and easy and basic for college students, and yet the recipe seems to fit very well within the parameters of the book.
Yeah, sweet potatoes are very healthy. Everyone loves their potatoes. Vegetable broth, chickpeas are great. Zucchini, thyme. I think variety. I was really looking for variety, too, when I went through the recipes. Kids getting out there. They're used to mom and dad style cooking, but maybe they want to try different types of food. And if you can't afford to go out all the time, you can always make something for yourself. And this does have a lot of different, you know, Chinese foods or different spices in there that are different for kids to try. It's kind of an exploration cookbook, too, because there are so many different recipes and styles and flavors in here that it's great to explore and try different things. And you're not limited at all, because if you're afraid of something, there's usually something else to make you happy in here.
Rachel Holcomb brought in one of the desserts from the Healthy College Cookbook, gingerbread cake with whipped cream on top. And tell us what went into it.
This is actually a little different. There's applesauce in it, which I've not normally used when baking, but it is.
And what's
great.
That for? Is that to lighten up the fat content?
I am honestly not sure, but actually that would make sense because there's no butter in it. There's just a little bit of sugar and molasses and some flour, but otherwise it's water and vegetable oil and applesauce and a little baking soda with cinnamon and ginger.
Well, let's try some of it.
Yes.
I'm being handed some gingerbread here. Mmm. That's really good. It's light.
Mm-hmm.
That applesauce really seems to do the trick in terms of making it moist.
It is really moist, which is so nice.
And it's not too sweet.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, it's delicious. Rachel Holcomb, thanks so much for coming on to Writer's Voice here to talk about the Healthy College Cookbook, Quick, Cheap, and Easy. It's got 300 recipes. They look terrific, and at least one of them is just delicious.
Thank you very much.
The Healthy College Cookbook is edited by Rachel Holcomb and written by Alexandra Nimitz, Jason Stanley, and Emmeline Starr. It's available from Story Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.